to begin, I think you just want to talk about your life and your upbringing. And were you graduated high school from Muskogee, correct? Over.
Yeah, I can just take off and start talking if you want on that
yeah.
level.
No, definitely.
Okay, well, I'll just do a brief, and then we can move on into the other areas that I think you want to hear about. But I'll start a little bit of family background, and then I'll talk about how I came up through Oklahoma, and we can take it from there. So to start with, my great-grandparents on my mother's side came to Indian Territory about 1904. They came from Rantoul, Illinois. They came in a wagon, and in the wagon, they had a piano in the wagon, so my grandmother could teach piano lessons. And then my great-grandfather also had a fiddle with him, a violin, but he played what was called longhair music back then, which meant classical music. So when they came to Indian Territory, they brought with them musical instruments. And their own background goes to, meaning my great-grandmother and my great-grandfather on my mother's side, their dads were drummers in a union drum corps. So the musical part of my family goes at least back to that point. So they come to Indian Territory and set up in Wagoner, Indian Territory. My grandfather was a barber, and the barbershop still exists. It's still a barbershop, obviously not his, but it's still there. Their sons were all musicians, all three of them, one of whom was my grandfather. And they played in a group together. And then my grandfather left Wagoner and came to where I am right now in Stillwater, to Oklahoma A&M, where he went, I think, just for 1 year. And had other aspirations and took off on his musical career. And so my grandfather had a long musical career as a pianist, an organist, and an accordionist. And so his first professional job was playing the organ for silent films in Okmulgee. And so that's really how his career got going. And he's a very interesting character in himself, and I can see why I do a lot of the things that I do, because he was a musician, he was also a professional photographer, and I have a lot of his films. He got into making films in the 1950s, and I have them. And then he was also kind of a gadget guy. And so I think a lot of my stuff came from there. Well, my mother went to Wagoner High School after she traveled around with them quite a bit. And she was an all-state viola player. 1 year they moved to Dallas, and that's where she met my father. And because she was a viola player and they didn't have concert band at her high school, they put her in the percussion section, which was next to my father, who was a percussionist. And in another class, because her last name was Fenton, his last name was Foley, he sat behind her. So as a result of being in the band and sitting behind her, they generated their relationship. So I had music coming at me from my mom's side, and then my dad was a percussion to be in the Navy band. So my mother went off with him to Norfolk, Virginia, and I was born July 17th, 1961 at a naval hospital in, well, the place of record is Philadelphia. Is where my birthplace is, but it's because my dad was stationed there. So after he does his thing and comes back to Texas, where they were living at the time, they got divorced. And upon divorce, my mother, she moved to Dallas first, and then we wound up back in Oklahoma. And so I went to part of the first grade in Wagoner, which is where my great-grandparents came in, as I mentioned, 1904. So it's kind of like going back home, because that's where she went to high school. So we lived there for a year, and then she remarried and moved back down to Texas for a little while. And then by the time I was in the fifth grade, which would be around 19 to Oklahoma, and we moved to the small community or outside of the small community of Hulbert, Oklahoma, which is in Cherokee County. And I went to the fifth and sixth grade there. And then after those 2 years, we moved to Wagner again. And so I went to junior high school in Wagner, and that's where I was in the band, and I played trombone, and that's really where I started my music education. And then after the ninth grade, my mother worked for an attorney in Muskogee, and so we moved to Muskogee, and that's where I went to high school. And once I got to Muskogee, I needed to work because my mom was a single parent and all of that. And so I kind of got a job working at a restaurant as a, you know, bussing tables and washing dishes and that sort of thing. But along about the same time, I got involved in magic, or, you know, performance magic. And so pretty quickly I progressed into being a quote professional magician at about age 14 or 15. I was doing magic shows at birthday parties and for civic groups and school groups and that kind of thing. So I didn't continue on in Muskogee High School band. When I got there, it was just more advanced and challenging. And I needed to work, so I did. And I got involved in magic, and so that's so to speak. And then when I was 16 in 1977, I went to the local radio station in Muskogee. And I asked him, you know, how could I get involved in radio? Because my father had been in radio and television in Texas. He'd started on board Navy ships, where Navy ships have a, it's called a sight system, which is like a little closed circuit radio TV thing going on for the ship. So he told me, I asked about his radio career, and he said, well, you just go to your local station and see if they need any help. So I did. Well, at that time, you had to take a test at a federal center to get your license, which I did. And I started being a DJ when I was 16, December 77, I think. And that was right at the height of the disco era, Saturday Night. I worked at the local station in Muskogee, KBIX Radio. And after that summer, I also worked at another radio station in Muskogee called KMUS, which was owned by Horace Boren of the Boren family that's famous in Oklahoma. And subsequent to that, having had two radio jobs now, mind you, I barely turned 17 at this time, I sort of bluffed my way into a job in Tulsa at a radio station there that was called KTFX at the time. And I started driving back and forth. And so in high school, I got out early at 1 o'clock because I didn't need any more credits than I could get by 1 o'clock. So I'd go home and I'd sleep until 11 or midnight. My mother would wake me up, and then I'd drive to Tulsa and do the overnight shift at the radio station. And so that went on for a little while till I actually had a wreck coming back from Tulsa in the morning, because I was kind of missing out on my high school life. And I went to a basketball game in Tulsa instead of going home and going to sleep. I went to Tulsa and went to a basketball game, then went to work, then tried to drive home. And that's where I fell asleep at the wheel. You know, again, age 17, trying to do everything at one time, and I had a wreck. And so that ended my Tulsa radio life. And subsequent to that, I got a job in Okmulgee working at the radio station there, which was a little closer than Tulsa. And so I worked there up until about a few months before I graduated high school. And I was starting to want to do things with my senior colleagues at that time. And so I left the radio station, and for about 3 months, I just did high school senior stuff, left and went to Houston. Because my grandmother lived there, my father lived there. So I went down there and I got a job as a water ski show announcer at Astro World. And so what I did was stood out on the platform in the middle of the lagoon and was the announcer for the water ski show. And so there was a whole routine that went with it. And that was my job that summer. Well, I also started to apply for some radio station jobs in Houston. Houston being a bigger market and me just having my background in Oklahoma, it wasn't enough to get a full-time job. I think somebody, I'd already done that, you know? And so my father suggested that I contact the military and see what opportunities they had. Now, again, we're talking 1979. Vietnam War had just been over for 4 years. So going in the military wasn't like super hip thing to do or anything. But I found out that, yes, in fact, you can go into the U.S. Army and be a broadcast journalist. Okay, I'm down for that. I took the test and I have a voice audition and all of that, basic training. And then I went off to the Defense Information School in Indianapolis. And I went through that program. I was the honor graduate from the program. And I wound up at the American Forces Network in Europe in Frankfurt, Germany. And so I was there for 22 months, I think, as a network radio producer and a DJ. And I had a radio show and got exposed to a lot of things there that I had never seen in Oklahoma. And toured. I mean, you have to imagine, you know, like 18 years old and all of a sudden you're in Europe. So that 22 months, I had an opportunity to go to Paris and London and Holland and Spain and Greece and all around Germany. So it made me more worldly just by having that experience. So I came back to the U.S. and I was stationed at U.S. Forces Command in Atlanta, Georgia at Fort McPherson. And I produced two programs that were pressed onto vinyl and sent out to radio stations all over the world. And they were music shows. One was a country one and one was a pop one. And they were sent out as public affairs programs and stations would air them, small stations that aired that kind of stuff. And I also started working with the music industry there because we had to go around to the various record labels and get records and bring them back for the shows. So I did that till I got out of the service, and that was August of 1982. And as a result of a musician I'd met in Europe who was in a band called Mother's Finest, he was a guitarist. His name was Gary Moore, still is. He said, well, if you're ever in Atlanta, look me up. Well, it turns out I got transferred to Atlanta, so I looked him up and went over to his house and we became friends. And at that time, Mother's Finest was kind of like break up and get back together. So he was forming his own band. And he said, I need a roadie, somebody to help build the equipment, drive the truck, put the equipment in the truck, take it to the venue, unload it, set it up. Gig goes on, whatever happens during the gig, you take care of the stage. When it's over, carry the equipment down, put it back in the truck, off to the next gig. So there was myself and two other guys, a lighting guy and a sound guy, and I was the roadie. And so we traveled all around the Southeast doing these shows with this band. And so, you know, I learned a lot there about sound and loading trucks and packing them and unpacking them and lights and sound. And I sort of did all the jobs when, you know, we had a lighting guy, a sound guy, and me. So at various times we had to rotate around to just help each other out. So I did that. And then the band broke up. And so what to do now? Well, the Army owed me a move. And so I thought, well, let me go to New York because I haven't really tried New York yet. My father was living there at the time, or actually he's living in Connecticut. So I went to New York. And I went to a local veterans, like employment agency, and the veterans guy at the employment agency. And he said, oh, you have radio background. Well, let me call a couple radio stations. So he called one, and sure enough, they said, come on over. And next thing you know, I've got a full-time job in White Plains, New York at a AM-FM combo, we call it. And I would be on AM, and I'd be on FM. And then I also worked at another radio station in Greenwich, Connecticut, where I was friends with a guy that worked there named Morgan Walker. His name was dad was Mort Walker, who's the Beetle Bailey illustrator. And so I was working at this station, and all of a sudden I was around a lot of people who were educated. Now, my story, the way it goes up to that point, was I had a lot of experience. I'd worked at radio stations in high school. I'd been to Europe. I'd worked on the big AFN headquarters. So I had this experience, but what I realized around all my peers and contemporaries was they went to college first and then they started breaking into the industry. So that was, I always felt I've always been a good reader and I always felt I was kind of smart, but I wasn't really super educated, because in high school, it's not that I didn't have the opportunity to be educated. It's just I was more interested in radio. And earlier before that, magic and school just didn't seem to apply to my real world environment. So I got to a point in New York, my first time there, that I was kind of uncomfortable, to be honest. You know, I had big thoughts and I knew I was kind of smart and I had a voice, and I was trained in voice and diction through the military. So I sounded more erudite and urbane than I really was, to be honest. And while I may have been able to sound like that, I didn't really think like that. And so at that point, I realized, you know, I think I'm going to go to college. And I just come from Fort McPherson, Atlanta. So I was still a resident of Georgia and had a girlfriend there. So I moved back to Atlanta and started going to a community college there, which was super cheap. It was DeKalb Community College, which is now part of the Georgia State system. And immediately I got involved at the radio station, but the sound man that I'd been on the worked with the band on, he had a gig at this local club called 688 in Atlanta. And he said, "Hey, we need a doorman. You want a job?" I was like, "Well, I was just in college. I didn't really have a job. I just kind of had a club at 688, which is a legendary club in Atlanta. And because I was a little bit older, and at the time, I also went into the Army Reserve because I could still do that. And in the Army Reserve, I went to Egypt and I traveled a little bit, but mainly when I got back to Atlanta, the Reserve, you just have to do it 1 weekend a month and like 2 weeks in the summer or some extended thing, which my extended thing was going to Egypt. But so I had real short hair. So I looked kind of like a punk rocker, but I was also Army. Well, as a result of all that, and I was just 21, I guess. Yeah, 1982. I was 21 when I got there. No, wait, 22, because I got out of the Army and then I went to New York and I came back. Well, at that time, the so-called alternative music scene was just really developing. So pretty soon I was confronted with all these, like, at that time, kind of underground, but significant figures in that realm, like the Beatles, these European groups, Einstürzende Neubauten, Cabaret Voltaire, whoever, you know, other bands you could bring up, and then the American hardcore scene. And so here I am, a doorman for the American hardcore scene, essentially. I became friends with RuPaul at that time, who's now a mega star, you know, and so we were friends and just that whole environment there. So I'm working at 688, I'm in the Army Reserve, and I'm going to DeKalb Community, WOTA, which stood for On the Air. And then I was also the editor of the school newspaper called The Open Door. So I was really just doing everything, you know, at that time. So I went to 2 years of college there, and I still remembered New York, and I wanted to do New York. I wanted to go there and see if I could make it. And so I applied to New York University, and I got in, and I went up there, and I got a job at a radio station in Connecticut. And then also, because when I was in Atlanta, I worked for NBC News for a year as a desk assistant. So and as a result of that, when I got to New York, I went to NBC and said, "Hey, I just worked for NBC in Atlanta, anything I can do here?" And so I got a job as a desk assistant at NBC Network Radio at the time. So, which was kind of a full circle for me, because there was a guy named Bill Vitka working there, and I'd heard him on the air when I was at my first station at KBIX in Muskogee. So for me, I'd kind of made it, even though I was just a desk assistant. It's like, man, when I was 16, I used to listen to you, you know, at the station on the network. Okay, well, anyway, so I worked there, but I also immediately got involved in WNYU, New York University's college radio station. And because I was a little bit older and I had the radio experience, it took me really deeply involved with the New York music scene, the New York music industry, record labels, that sort of thing. And then some of the bands that I'd worked with in Atlanta, 688, are now becoming, quote, college radio bands. So it's the development of that whole era, REM and, you know, U2 and The Cure and, you know, so on and so forth. I mean, Los Lobos, as popular as they came out of that alternative environment, college radio environment, and then became big. Red Hot Chili Peppers were part of that alternative environment, became mainstream. So I was there for 5 years, 85 to 90 in New York, and worked a bunch of radio stuff, did a bunch of voiceover stuff, but went to school, you know, so I got my bachelor's degree and then almost all my master's degree. And then I just kind of got burned out on New York, to be honest. I love New York still yet to this day. If you're not from there, you didn't grow up there, and you go there, you're always a visitor, it seems like, even though I hadn't lived any place as long as I'd lived in New York. But it starts to wear on you because the pace is so fast and there's so much happening. You live several lifetimes, you know, in New York, it seems like. So after 5 years, I was just kind of worn out on it, and I'd never been to California. Again, girlfriend from the Berkeley area. And so she said, well, I'm ready to go back to California. And I was like, well, I've never been there before, so let's try that. So I did. I would say that by the end of my time in New York, I made periodic trips back to Oklahoma to see my mom. And I'd go to places like the Illinois River. And I just, you know, compared to New York or the city anyway, Oklahoma just seemed beautiful. I'd get reminded of that every time. Well, because I was kind of homesick when I was in New York, I started reading. I went to the NYU library and I found every book they had on Oklahoma. And I started reading all of it. And in addition to that, in my father's garage up there, he had a stack of jazz books because, remember, he was a musician. One time, just a one-time deal, he played with Duke Ellington, right? So he's got all this jazz stuff. And so I found a book, and I might still have it back here somewhere, that's it listed some of the significant jazz musicians from Oklahoma. Not as an aggregate, but I was looking through, and I saw like Jay McShann, Muskogee, Oklahoma. What? Barney Kessel, Muskogee, Oklahoma. Really? Don Bias, just this Muskogee kept popping out at me from this jazz history book. So it got me thinking, and I started reading more. And I met there's a writer named Robert Palmer, and he wrote a book called Deep Blues. And he's a real significant American music historian. He's deceased now. And he came to New York with a band, a young band, and he was playing clarinet in the band. And we had him on the station. I really wanted to meet him because of Deep Blues, and he had a band, and with these kids, I'm like, okay, whatever, we'll play them too. But I kind of wanted to talk to Robert Palmer. So they were playing that night at a club called Tramps, and I went. And after the show, he was at the bar, and I went up and started talking to him, told him I was from Oklahoma. And I was really interested in the music from Oklahoma. And he said, do you know about the Oklahoma? So I started looking into them, and I found out all their history, in the history of the territory bands of Indian Territory, how they become the Count Basie Orchestra, and all this legendary mythological stuff practically that goes along with the Oklahoma City Blue Devils. So I started looking into them. And then while I was in New York, I started collecting Oklahoma music stuff. So I started buying books and records, and, you know, I found some cool stuff that I still have. Okay, so essentially what I did was kind of mythologized and romanticized Oklahoma to a point where I had to come back here. I had to. And so while I was in California, I finished my master's at NYU, and I started applying to Oklahoma State and OU for a PhD program. And I didn't know which one that I would do, because I really barely knew. I mean, I'd been to OU a couple times as a high schooler to ball games. I'd been to Stillwater maybe once, because my office supply store here called Fenton Office Supply, that's still here today. But I really didn't know the places, you know. But I'd lived in New York. I'd lived in Europe, Atlanta, New York City, the Bay Area of San Francisco. And so coming back to Oklahoma, when you compare Stillwater to Norman, Norman's more of a little bit of a suburban kind of setting. It's still sort of an extension of Oklahoma City in a lot of ways, whereas Stillwater seemed this isolated, small college town. And because I'd already been as urban as you can be, which was New York City, I wanted the complete opposite. And then I know this is being recorded for posterity, so I'll go ahead and say it. I went to Norman and visited OU, and there was just something about the attitude there that almost seemed like they were trying too hard to be something. Whereas I came to Stillwater and I went to the English department here, and it seemed more down to earth. You know, it just seemed more of my, what I really wanted. I didn't want something that purported to be the best ever in the world at anything, because I'd already been in New York City. So when I got to Stillwater, so that was one part of it, and no slight on anybody. I have a lot of really good friends at OU. I love the Western History Collections. I did a lot of research down there. I've done a lot of talking down there. There's a lot of good people there. I'm just talking about my sensibility in 1993, right? When I'm a little different in the program, I could see that I was going to get to do whatever I wanted at Stillwater. Whereas at Norman, I was going to get more narrowly defined. And I hadn't really defined exactly what I wanted to do, so I didn't want to be narrowly defined. I wanted to be more open. And at that time, OSU had what was called a creative dissertation, which meant that if you could convince the advisors that you had a good topic, you could do it. So it's like, okay, well, that's for me. So I became a TA and I started teaching. And going to Oklahoma State, met a lady, got married, we have a son. That's, you know, the family track. And then I started getting into my research. And what I wanted to do was some kind of Oklahoma music history, which wouldn't be a music theory dissertation, but would be more of a critical dissertation about Oklahoma music and its standing in world music history. So I presented this idea and I was immediately told that's way too broad. You've got to narrow it down. And so there was a well-known, very respected, I've never met him, but I have the highest regard for Dr. William Savage of OU history. And he wrote a book called Singing Cowboys and All That Jazz in the early 80s. As far as I know, it's the first book that really tried to tell the Oklahoma music story in a lot of ways. And it has its limitations, but at the same time, he says something, and I'm paraphrasing now, along the lines of, there's still a lot more work to be done in Oklahoma music. Muskogee alone would make for a fascinating study. And I was like, hey, that's what I needed. It was some kind of scholarly direction and verification that Muskogee has something unique going on, which went all the way back to me in my dad's garage finding this book with it. So that's what I proposed next, was like, I want to explain why so many significant jazz musicians came from Muskogee. They're like, well, okay, well, that sounds good. So so that's what I started on. And so I started researching. Well, first of all, to do that, you have to know Oklahoma history, and you have to know about Indian territory, and especially Muskogee, how it all came together, and the Muskogee Creek Nation, and then the enslaved people of African descent, and then how the removals happened, and those people come with them, and then how after the Civil War, other people of African descent arrive, and it creates a very dynamic artistic environment, certainly musically. So at that time, Jay McShann was still alive. Claude Williams was still alive. Barney Kessel was still alive. Clarence Love was still alive. And so I got a chance to talk to them at that time. And so I would interview them as part of my work to find out what they had to say about growing up in Muskogee and how they got involved in music and all of that. So that was that began a scholarly trajectory regarding Oklahoma music and understanding where it comes from and all that. Alongside that, my then wife, I am divorced, is Muscogee Creek. And so my son is Muscogee Creek. And so as a result of that, we started attending a Muscogee Creek Baptist Church because we agreed that we wanted to make sure that our son had an opportunity to learn about his cultural life ways. And as they related to both the Christian perspective of Muscogee people and then also the ceremonial and traditional ways. So that's kind of a whole nother track, but what it led me to was church. And with my music history ear, I started listening to these hymns and I immediately said, well, there's a little bit more of the story in that I actually recorded one day with permission some of the hymns because I had a question about a song, a word they were saying. And I joked, well, hey, I'm just going to bring a tape deck in here and record it. Then you guys can tell me what's up. And they said, that's okay. People bring them in all the time. Try not to make any noise when you're recording. Okay, fine. So I recorded it and I get home and I listened to it. I was like, wait, that sounds like a slave spiritual. Why do Muscogee Creek hymns sound like slave spirituals? Well, that sent me on this whole other path of trying to figure out how that happened with regard to Muscogee Creeks and so on and so forth. And that's where we get the film, This May Be the Last Time, which is another story wherein I met Sterling Harjo because we were showing one of his films at Roger State where I teach. And he's Creek and Seminole. And he had a couple of Creek hymns in his film, Barking Water. And I said, boy, I like those Muscogee Creek hymns you have in there. And he said, well, you know, more or less, well, what do you know about that? Me not looking like the kind of person who would know about Muscogee Creek hymns. And I said, well, you know, my son's mother, my son, the church, I listened, I recorded, I researched it, and I found out all the stuff about it. And so I was telling him about it. And he goes, well, that's fascinating. We got to make a movie about that. And I said, okay, well, call me. Sure enough, he did. Next thing you know, we do make a movie. Next thing you know, we're at Sundance. And next thing you know, that's part of, you know, my story now. Alongside that, in 1996, I applied for an adjunct position at Roger State in Claremore. And let me back up just 1 second. When I started in Stillwater in, I think, 93, I was coming out of the campus and there was a big RV and it had speakers on top of it. And they were blasting out like Red Hot Chili Peppers or something. And there was a sign on the side of it that said The Spy. And so I was like, well, okay, what's that about? So I went over and I met the guys in there. And they said, yeah, we just started the station and we just made it alternative. And I was like, oh, cool. I've been an alternative DJ in New York. You guys need any help on the weekends or anything like that? And they're like, well, call us up, blah. I called, next thing you know, I'm on the weekends. So now I'm Spy Weekend DJ, original Spy, not the contemporary Spy that's part of KOSU. That has its own trajectory and story. Well, within about a year, maybe two, I became the program director of KSBI here in Stillwater, the Spy. And so I made it what I felt an alternative station should really be. And now we're talking 95, 6, 7, that range, okay? And in that time, a lot of things are happening here in Stillwater because of the red dirt scene and all of that's a whole other story. But I essentially started to do at the Spy what I'd done at WNYU in New York and then applied my commercial experience to the format and formalities necessary. And it started to get a lot of attention. And, it, you know, that's what, to me, and I'm not blowing my horn or anything, but, I mean, I sort of am, that it did. So, contemporarily, it's on KOSU, Ferris O'Brien, all respect to him, runs it, you know, now. But at the time, he had a little record store here in Stillwater. And we worked out a deal where he did overnight dance music show or something like that. You know, I set it up as this entity. He had a record store and, you know, that it kind of went from there. Well, around 1998, the owners of the SPY sold it. They were the same people who owned the Stillwater News Press. Well, once it was sold, the new owners came in and kind of changed the dynamic. And I was like, okay, well, I'm out of here because I don't want to do that. I want to, you know, I've already worked in commercial radio in New York. And so I don't want to do it this way. So at the time, two things happened. I'd already started to adjunct at Roger State, which at that time was Roger State College. And they had a radio station. And so I started getting involved in the radio station there. And in addition to that, they put me on TV to start teaching classes on Roger State University television. RSU has the only fully powered independent television station of any university in the state. Other universities have cable stations, but nobody has an actual transmitter and tower. Okay. And it's not part of OETA. It's an independent entity. So I started teaching classes on there. And because I had a little bit of Native American background with search, they said, hey, Hugh, we need somebody to teach a Native American class. Do you have enough background to do it? So I immediately contacted some of my mentors, like Dr. Pete Koser, who taught at OSU for a long time, Bacone, Muscogee Creek Nation. And I said, hey, here's the situation I'm in. And I have an opportunity to do a class on television regarding Native American history and current events. Should I do it? I'm non-Native, but it's an opportunity that otherwise, when he thought it'd be a good idea, really like, it needed the go ahead or the green light from a Native educator and upfront say, I'm not this, but here's what I'm gonna do. So what I started doing was contacting every tribe in Oklahoma and asking them if they had a public information officer or an educational person or cultural person who would talk to me on camera for my class so we could present Native history from the Native point of view. And I always got somebody. And so I traveled to every tribal facility. I'm not sure I had an interview with every one or two from that era. And so that's what I started to do, was put Native people on television. Instead of me saying, okay, here's the history of North American Indians, I said, today we're going to learn about the Wichita, and here's Strafford Williams, who is the cultural officer of the Wichita, and here he is. Turn him loose. Let him talk. So that went on, and as a result of that, I started to see some themes evolving, and one of the early themes was the stereotypical depiction of Native Americans in popular culture, especially in Oklahoma, and especially as it relates to athletics. And so I went out just on my own with a little prosumer camera, a little high-8 camera, and I think it's consumer camera. I don't even consider the high-8 prosumer. I think it's consumer. And I started videotaping high school football games and how Native American people were depicted at those games. And then I bring it back and put it on television. Well, that started to generate controversy and interest. And next thing you know, I'm doing more of it. Next thing you know, people are asking me to talk. Next thing you know, I put together a documentary. Next thing you know, I'm going places to show the documentary and talk. Remember, like in its nascent stages, in the mid to late 90s. As a matter of fact, at YouTube at that time, you could only put on a 10-minute video, you know, whereas now you could put on one that's 24 hours long if you have enough time to upload it, I guess. So we kind of had that various tracks going on at that time. Alongside all that, in the middle 90s, I got contacted by a gentleman named Tony Kai, who worked for the Greater Muscogee Development Corporation. I think it's a corporation, Muscogee Development. And he was interested in starting some kind of Hall of Fame for Oklahoma musicians. Would I get involved? And I was like, okay. So I became a founding board member of the Oklahoma Music Hall of Fame. And I'm still the induction selection committee chair. I was working on the ballot this morning, as a matter of fact. And so I've been involved with that organization for 5-6 years, something like now. So we have all these tracks going on. first track, we'll just leave that over here, right? And but I've got my radio TV thing, and then I have the music thing happening that culminates in, you know, my Oklahoma Music Guide, which is this book about Oklahoma music. And then I've got my scholarship going with regard to like jazz from Muskogee, Oklahoma music, Muskogee Creek hymns, the mascot thing, you know, all that's happening. And then around when I left KSPI in 1998, not only did I start volunteering at the college, I was the son of the owner of KUSH Radio in Cushing. And so I said, hey, Sean, I'm not going to work at the Spy anymore. How about we do Americana music at the Cush, and I'll do the native radio program that I started at the Spy? And he goes, okay, I can't pay you. I was like, I don't care. I just want to do it. So I started in 1998, AM director, and still running Americana format. And it is a nationally recognized station monitored in Nashville. And I still do the Native American program on Saturday morning there. And the Native program is on Sunday morning at RSU Radio, although I record that one every week. And so I have all these different tracks going on. Then somewhere, whenever the Humanities Council contacted me about the Smithsonian exhibit, I had all this stuff going on. So I was able to bring all these resources together, background and knowledge together, because Dr. Bob Blackburn, who's now the retired director of the Oklahoma History Center, gave the Humanities Council my name as the potential consulting scholar and traveling roots music. And once I saw the exhibit and what it was, I was like, well, this is going to be easy, because Oklahomans had contributed to practically every section of it, whether it was American Indian music, all the subgenres of country music, blues, folk music, country music. I mean, we're all part of it. So that's kind of how that happened. So when I, you know, do the quick version of my life, if there is one, there's being connected to Oklahoma for, I guess we could call me fourth generation, I suppose. My great grandparents weren't born here, but they came here in a wagon during Indian Territory days. So that counts for something. And then my grandmother, that was not on my certificate, says Indian Territory. And so there's all that. And then there's the radio TV stuff. And I've become a video editor, so I've done a lot of like museum type documentaries and just a lot of other video things. And most recently, a tragic thing happened. My friend Sean Kelly was killed in a car wreck, and I took over his role. And so I like doing that. It's just a fun thing on Friday night. I enjoy following the team and calling the games. And then I guess the final component of all this is my music, which I do play music, and I play in a kind of a goofy folk rock band called Slap Out. And we've had that going for, I don't know if it's 20 years yet, but it's like 18 years or something like that, with Derek McCubbin, who lives here in Stillwater. And we were in a band in college days called the Delicious Militia. And so everybody graduated and took off, and then Derek came back and I was the only one left. And he said, hey, you want to play? And at that time, I'd learned to play a little bit of guitar, enough to what we call cowboy chord, which means some basic chords and make up some songs and, you know, play woody. So I've been doing that for several years, and we have, I think, 4 albums or something like that. We have a Christmas album, 3 albums, and an EP. And so I've got that track, but that's probably the least serious. And the least thing that people are actually interested in is, you know, Slap Out, although it's a really fun part of my life because I get to play music. And the thing about that is it informs my music writing. So I may not be the greatest, but I know what it is to play an instrument, play in a group, write songs, vocalize songs, play in front of a crowd, have a crowd with you, have a crowd disinterested. And then when you have that experience, then you see somebody that's great. I mean, top of the line, because I've emceed a ton of Oklahoma Music Hall of Fame shows. So I've seen a lot of really top of the line, great people up front. And what that shows you is, A, I'm not that. You know, I appreciate even more what they do because you've done it a little bit, you know, here and there. So those are really my tracks, the Oklahoma life history, the radio, TV, the music scholarship and music, being around music because of radio. I've been a DJ since I was 16. I still talk to music promoters this morning. I take music calls every Tuesday from 10 to noon. Releases for KUSH. And then the scholarship thing that I mentioned. And that gets us to the Smithsonian exhibit. And that's, you know, the Reader's Digest condensed version of my life in a lot of ways up to this point.
You've definitely made this perhaps the easiest interview. Also, I would say one of the most fascinating, because I had written down an entire index card full of what I assumed were to be obscure questions I would bring up, including Slap Out. I did find a Christmas video of you playing the trombone, which I thought was pretty nice. It's a phenomenal story, and I'm just going to continue until I end this with a question because I think there is kind of a delay. I would like to touch a little bit more on your contribution to that Smithsonian, I think it's the Museum on Main Street. If you don't mind talking a little bit more about that and just sort of your relationship with the introduction of the Oklahoma Humanities as well. It's really fascinating stuff.
Thank you. Well, with regard to that particular Museum on Main Street exhibit I got to be a part of, it was really great fun for me and very interesting and validating in a lot of ways, because here we had this national exhibit that was going to go around Oklahoma, but Oklahoma had so much to do with it. And so I was able to put together a lot of my knowledge and experience and go around the state to the places where it was being installed and flesh it out with Oklahoma. And that's the important thing to think about with regard to Oklahoma music. And that's what I say in my book, is that Oklahoma music has contributed mightily to every subgenre of American music. So when that exhibit started going around, it was an opportunity for me to further understand the state, because in each place we went, I'd try and find somebody who had contributed to that exhibit. And what was nice about Museum on Main Street is we went to kind of the four corners of the state. So, you know, we were in Altus, and then, you know, Northwestern Oklahoma and Alva, right? And then it's hard to remember like all the places that we actually went, but it was really a good experience because I got to meet people in all these places and find out things that I didn't know about maybe musicians that came from that area or stories from that area. But it gave me an opportunity to go to these places and lecture to people or talk to them about Oklahoma music as it applied to this particular exhibit, and made so many impacts on the world music. And so I got to bring up American Indian music or Muscogee Creek hymns and talk about that history, the way the powwow gets going in Oklahoma, every tribe having its own traditional music background. And then I was able to go into the folk music history of the state. And I learned more going through that than I had before about cowboy music, for instance, and the way in which cowboy music evolved in the state as a result of the cattle trails that came through here. And then the whole folk music part, you know, you don't talk about American folk music without talking about Woody Guthrie. Well, that makes it really easy, because back to being able to play three chords and talk a little bit. You know, you can have a lot of fun with Woody Guthrie songs if you can just play three chords and, you know, do his lyrics. because they teach you about the Dust Bowl and the Okies and the poor perspective that people had in the 1930s. Validating for me, not only that, but the Humanities Council worked out a deal with me where if I would get my book revised, they'd buy X amount of copies of it. And I was like, okay, well, I'll just add that to all the other stuff I have to do. So I just wore myself out doing an edition of the book so they could buy some, so we could have them for teachers and they could use them for other purposes. And so in a lot of ways, they, you know, were kind of a patron for me. You know, they helped me. I was already motivated. I was just out of time. And so I had to prioritize things. Well, they upped that to a priority and got that book back out, which helped me keep it out, which is still out today. And I'm actually, one of the other projects I have going is updating it. So I've got the book, but then I have, I'll just hold this up. You know, this is the update for the next edition. So this is just alphabetically organized articles, notes, or whatever on the individual musicians in the book. So I have to go back into InDesign, open the book back up, and then update the entries. And so in a lot of ways, that exhibit, you know, made all that happen again. And so that was really good. So not only did I get to travel around the state and learn about things I didn't know, because I do love Oklahoma and all it represents romantically and mythologically, but I also talk a lot about realities, whether it's the history of racism or the history of privilege in the state, or the disparities that exist socially and economically in the state, educationally, health-wise. These are important things as well. But my focus, of course, is not to go out and lecture people on that. You know, I talk about is music. And but within that exhibit, I was able to talk about things like with the Muscogee Creek hymns, how you talk about, you know, that being a tricultural musical product of Muscogee Creeks, people of African descent, and people of Scottish descent, of which I'm of Scottish descent. So it was a very interesting way to look at how Oklahoma fostered this cultural collective. And that sent me down some really interesting paths and allowed me to talk to people about it. So I could go out and be kind of serious, but at the same time be kind of jokey. And then on top of that, be informative and educational. And then I could say, now let's go look at this exhibit and let me show you what I'm talking about. And so we could walk through and expound it upon. And it gave us an opportunity to see the depth and richness of Oklahoma music history in the context of a national story. And so that museum on Main Street is great because it brings Smithsonian level materials, knowledge, and understanding to local communities that otherwise would not have access to that kind of exhibit and information. So it was a good year. It lasted a year, or actually it probably lasted more like 18 months because there was a whole pre thing up to it. And then we did it for a year and then there was the follow-up. And so it was a really good experience and I really enjoyed it. And so I'm thankful to the Humanities Council that it happened and Dr. Blackburn, that even brought my name up to start with. And that we got to do it because forever now I can say I was a Smithsonian scholar. So that's nice, you know, and it's just one of the many positives that came out of that.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like it was a very pleasant experience. I also appreciate on behalf of Oklahomans, you're sort of working as a cultural paragon for the humanities of this state. And I wrote down earlier that it seems like your love of Oklahoma was born out of the absence of it, like the homesickness is really what fueled your fire to return from the, you know, the hustle and bustle of the Big Apple. And that's really fascinating to me because I think a lot of people are influenced by their surroundings, not, you know, what they're hometowns and stuff. A last question, I'm a little more abstract, is what do you think the future of humanities in Oklahoma and in the larger picture, specifically because you are a scholar of Native American studies, like what do you think the future of Native American representation in this country and, like I said, the general humanities at large for this state will hold? Of course, there's no right answer because it's all, you know, abstract about the future, but what's your take?
I have a lot of things to say about that. I'll get back to the imagery depiction and all of that, because I think there's a shift going on right now that we were talking about 20 years ago, 10 years ago. Tulsa Union getting rid of their R word mascot. That was a big change, because 20 years ago when we were talking about it, they said it was an outsider's point of view. So we're about what we think. Well, now people from within that community said, we don't like it. We want to get rid of it. And they got rid of it in Oklahoma City, the South Oklahoma City, to not being the R word. Capitol Hill, I believe, is that high school there. So there's a little shift there. The principal chief of the Cherokee Nation, Chuck Hoskin Jr., asking Jeep to stop putting Cherokee on their Jeeps. This is all in the wake of the last year of social change with regard to corporate brands changing. Land O'Lakes Lady, Mrs. Butterworth, Aunt Jemima, the Washington Pro Football Team. Just today, I noticed Dr. Seuss, some of his early books are now being taken out of publication. Disney finally recognizing that the images of Native people and Peter Pan are cartoonish and inappropriate. And so now they've got either a warning label before it shows on Disney Channel, Warner Brothers taking some of the Bugs Bunny cartoons out of circulation. So there is a cultural shift that's happening that is as a result of people learning more, you know more. And it's not the job of the non-fill-in-the-blank to tell the fill-in-the-blank how they should feel about something. And I don't mean to genericize that fill-in-the-blank, but you can put all kinds of things in there. It's up to the fill-in-the-blank entity to decide what is good or bad for them. And so finally, we have some people listening to them. And so I think that's good. Building on that would be fill in the blank entity telling their own story. So let's start with the FAM, the First Americans Museum in Oklahoma City, a museum that will be interpreted through the eyes of Native people. And the stories that are going to be told there are from the Native perspective. And the first two exhibits, as I understand, are federally recognized, and the Yuchi, who are not federally recognized, but are generally considered a separate tribal entity, even though they're part of the Muscogee Creek Nation. So you have each tribe able to tell its story. And the first exhibit that's coming from the Smithsonian are artifacts that were taken from Oklahoma in the 1800s and early 1900s that were tribal property. And those things are being returned, and they're going to be part of the exhibit at the FAM, but they're going to be described and explained in the context of the tribe. So they'll have the word in the tribal language for that item, and then the tribal explanation of what that item is. In addition to that, you have on the Native thing, before I leave that, you have this story getting ready to be told by Martin Scorsese from the David Grand book, Killers of the Flower Moon, where they're going to approach honestly and brutally the story of the Osage murders and how in people were murdered for their oil and mineral wealth by conservators that were appointed to help them. At the same exact time that's going on, the Tulsa race massacre is happening. So those are concurrent events, the Osage murders and the Tulsa race massacre. So now you've got Osage people involved, as they were with David Graham when he wrote the book, Killers of the Flower Moon, and involved with Martin Scorsese. I noticed last week, Scorsese and Mr. DiCaprio were in Pawhuska, I think is where they were, and they had a big listening session with Osage people. And so they want to tell that story accurately, but Osage people are involved. In addition to that, you have this new Tulsa Greenwood Museum that's, you know, targeted toward the race massacre, but then talking about and celebrating what Black Wall Street was and what Greenwood was before the massacre. Because that's a, you can't not, if you don't, you have, if you're not a sensitive person, I guess maybe it doesn't bother you, but you can't walk around the Greenwood area and see those little plates in the sidewalk that says, now I don't have a name in mind, but I'm using an example, you know, like Joe Smith's candy shop is one. And then the next one's like Joe Jones barbershop. And then they're it's like almost like a cemetery, that there are these little plaques where these buildings were that were burned. Because people were essentially jealous of what Black people had evolved to economically and socially and culturally by that time. But it's that same really significant African-American social, cultural, and educational development that led to all the jazz musicians coming from Muskogee. You know, so that that story of the Black towns and the Black history of Oklahoma and the race massacres now being told by people of African-American descent. And so we get their story from their own point of view. So we're getting past that time where it's non-fill-in-the-blank people telling the stories for those people. And so I think that that's a really positive development. And is going to just continue to grow. I think about Sterling Harjo, who I worked with on the film, this makes, which is called Reservation Dogs. And it's native teenagers in Okmulgee who are going through their life. And it's like part comedy, but also part social commentary on what native youth experience. So I think all this is super positive, but then I'll go to the next level, which is this year and maybe 2 years before this are the first years that our K through 12 population in Oklahoma is more than 50% non-white. So that tells you that in 20 years from now, we're in 2021, 2040, those kids are going to be grown up, having their own kids, with jobs for a multicultural environment. And this is just raw data. It's not me over-interpreting anything. It's just how it is. Now, you can separate out the urban areas of Tulsa, Oklahoma City, Lawton from the rural environments from the state, and you get a little more understanding of the racial makeup of the state if you want to go along racial lines, which are, of course, social constructs. You know, we all have... we're all humans, you know, not to oversimplify that or cliche it or anything. And race is a significant aspect of our world, especially in Oklahoma. But people are having to adjust their feelings and what they think is true based on society, you know, developing and evolving. And people say this a lot, but, you know, the first Senate Bill number one was a separate the races law. So initially, you know, there was a big trip of African-American leaders from Oklahoma, and they went to talk to Teddy Roosevelt. And before Oklahoma was a state, and they said, look, if you make Oklahoma state, they're going to disenfranchise us. Roosevelt says, no, we won't put that, will not be in the state charter. So it wasn't. However, as soon as the legislature convened, Senate Bill number one was separate the races. And I separate facilities laws, what it was, I believe separate waiting areas and train stations, or somebody can correct me on that somewhere down the road. But the fact is that first Senate bill separated the races. That's 1907. So now you got a duality and now you got animosity. And it's only 14 years before there's a Tulsa race massacre. So we have to continue dealing with that. And I was just on a call earlier with our university social justice. Why today should we feel guilty about something that happened 100 years ago? You know, my answer, I didn't do it. Why am I responsible? Well, then you get into some real serious stuff about generational trauma and genetic trauma and the negative, tragic experiences that people had 200 years ago feed in to the biology of people today, which can lead them toward depression or substance abuse or, you know, other negative social actions. So back to the original question, which is, how do I see people, the images of people evolving, or the way we perceive people evolving? I think it's changing for the good, because those people are now starting to tell their own stories. And we as a state have to recognize where we came from, because the future of Oklahoma looks a lot more like multicultural and non-white. That's just a fact. That's how the state started. It didn't start as a white state. It started as a, Indian activist says, a federal prison for Native people. Okay, you got to go to Indian territory. Well, now you can't leave. Well, what's that? And that's where the story of Standing Bear comes in. That's the ultra humanity story of Oklahoma, to me, is Standing Bear. And that's not taught in the public schools. And that's Ponca Chief Standing Bear, and the quick, very quick version, because it's been written out way better than I'm going to say in 2 minutes, is that, his son died here in the Ponca Reservation. He took him back to the homelands. He got arrested once he took the son and buried him back there in the Niobrara River, current Nebraska. Arrested. Hey, why am I arrested? Well, you left your reservation. Well, how come I can't leave? Am I not free? Am I not covered by the Constitution? Is there a set of laws for the white man, a set of laws for the Indians? Well, then the judge had to rule what? He had to rule whether or not Standing Bear was actually a person, because at that time, Native people were considered less than human. So after Standing Bear's powerful oratory, you're a human. Well, if you're a human and you're in this country, then you're covered by the Constitution. And so that's a humanity story that needs to be told over and over and over and over. And it happened. Children books, PBS, big statue in Ponca, but still not a lot of people know it. So the stories are there for us to tell. The trick is finding people who will tell them emphatically and passionately. And then there need to be people who want to hear it and want to listen to understand who we are better as Oklahomans.
But one of the things that I had written as far as notes, and this will probably be the me wrapping this up for now. Speaking of oratory skills, bravo for this whole experience. But it seems as though with your, especially with the Rogers State, where you allowed people of, fill in the blank to give fill in the blank perspective, that seems like a great way to let those voices be heard. And I do think that what you were saying is very resonating in terms of not just Oklahoma, but the humanities as a field of discipline, sort of reckoning with its problematic past. I have no further questions for you. If there's anything else you'd like to say, feel free. And if not, we can wrap it up here if you're so inclined.
Okay. Here's what I would conclude by saying regarding the humanities.
Sure.
I thought a lot about this. We teach humanities in the Western tradition, and what is the humanities? It's the things humans produce, their existence to themselves, symbolize their existence to themselves, metaphorize existence, songs, poems, artwork, however you want to go with that, foodways, architecture, the sports we play even. All of these things add up to the humanities, and that's why music is so great, because everybody has some kind of music. Everybody across the globe has some kind of music. And it's a good way, the universal language, sometimes we say it that way. But humanities are really, really, really important for a well-rounded person to have in their toolkit for understanding life. Because occasionally you might get a song that says exactly what you've been feeling, but you couldn't say it yourself. And so you listen to that song because it confirms things that you think and feel. So it may not be the most financially remunerative pursuit, meaning the humanities, but it is infinitely rewarding spiritually, intellectually, and these are the things that make our heart strong and make us good people, is the humanities are a bridge between different people's lifestyles, because all of that adds up to having an appreciation for our own lives as a result of somebody else's life. Because what is identity? And, you know, I've talked a lot about this in other places before. Identity is three things. It's language that you speak. It's the regular events that you attend, whatever those are, whether they're ceremonies or ball games or fairs or clubs or whatever. And the third thing is the community to which you have a commitment that you don't have to be reminded about or told about. So language, events or ceremonies, and community commitment. And once you determine those three things about yourself, you know kind of where you fit in. Well, what the humanity shows us is how other people use language, events, and community commitment to fulfill their lives. And by looking at them through things like documentaries, public television, books, magazines, now the web, of course, is this infinite resource. We learn more about them, but we also learn more about ourselves. And to me, that's one of the great things about studying humanities. And so that's pretty much where I'd wrap it up.
Fantastic. Absolutely. Thank you for your time. I know you said that this is the second. I won't make you stay an hour and a half. I think an hour and 15 minutes is plenty. I appreciate you working with the delay as well. And that's all I have. I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day and week. Thank you again.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Chris.